Hartelijk welkom bij Voorzorg, de podcast voor de zorg gemaakt door de redactie van Skipper en Zorgvisie. Ditmaal kunt u luisteren naar een Engelstalige aflevering met als gast Don Berwick, oprichter van het Institute of Healthcare Improvement in Boston, tweemaal verkozen tot meest invloedrijke persoon in de Amerikaanse gezondheidszorg en een absolute autoriteit op het gebied van kwaliteit en veiligheid in de zorg. Hij gaat in gesprek met senior-redacteur Bart Kiers.
What this President Trump has done is nothing less than murderous. It's homicidal, killing people through his stroke of his pens.
Welcome, Don Berwick. I'm honored to have you in our podcast for Zorg as guest. You have an astonishing career in improving the quality and safety in healthcare, and I want to go back to 1982, at the very start of your career, and this was at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, where you were working, and there at a meeting at the Kenmore Center with about 25 doctors, you confronted them with data on how good they achieved. For instance, you had measured infant mortality, infection rates, etc., and you presented it to them as a reality check. And, well, then it ended up, or it started, when one of the colleagues threw something at you. It was perhaps the only time in your life that that happened. Maybe you can take us back to what happened there.
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again, Bart. Thanks for your interest in this field. You're recalling a meeting at the Harvard Community Health Plan. That was the health maintenance organization that I worked in. I was a pediatrician seeing patients, but also vice president for quality of care measurement. That was the title I had. The executives of that health maintenance organization had become worried about quality of care. They knew they were putting financial pressure on the system, and they wanted to make sure they were not harming people. So I was given a department and a budget to measure quality. The incident you're referring to, I was using a patient satisfaction measure that had been developed and well-tested by the RAND Corporation. And as part of my job, vice president for quality of care measurement, my staff had organized giving out about 20 or 30 questionnaires to patients of each doctor. So in this particular center, which you're correct, was the Kenmore Center, the one I worked in, I met with the Department of Internal Medicine, and the doctors were assembled, and I passed out the report from the surveys of the patients so every doctor could see his or her scores. We didn't reveal their names. There was a sheet of paper, so maybe Bart was Dr. E, and you would know that that was you, but you wouldn't know who the others were. But it would allow you to see how your satisfaction scores were, how your patient satisfaction scores were compared to other doctors.
It's interesting, but it's confronting also.
It was an assessment with a tool. And you're right. In the back of the room, I remember one of the doctors, actually a friend of mine, stood up, and she took her report and walked to the front of the room. She rolled her report into a ball, and she threw the ball at me, and she walked out of the room.
She was not happy.
Yeah, she was frustrated, not happy, angry. And that was a relative turning point for me. That and a few other incidents began to convince me that simply measuring performance and feeding it back to these good doctors was not helpful, not productive. The way to interpret her behavior was, I soon realized it was she was helpless. She was seeing patients, doing her very best, and she didn't want them to be unhappy, but she was trapped in whatever system was around her. If the patients were angry because they waited too long to see her, that wasn't totally in her control at all. It had to do with the scheduling system and the ergonomics of the place. So it was feedback, and the only thing it could do is make her feel bad or good, but it couldn't help her, and that was what her gesture was, I think, emphasizing.
maybe we can learn something from this for today, actually, because the doctors still have some reserved attitude towards transparency. I see this in the Netherlands, where we have 31 sets of outcome indicators, which should produce transparency for about 50% of the disease burden. And it took quite a while to develop it, but it's not used, it's not implemented. And it's partly because of technical reasons, but it's also because a reluctance from doctors to get their results public. Can you understand why doctors feel this way in hospital and how you can shift it? What's a delicate way?
Well, I mean, walk in their shoes. What does that feel like? So, Bart, I've been interviewed by probably 50 people this year, and I have here in front of me a sheet of paper, and I've given every one of them a rating, and I'm about to hand you that paper, and it will show that of the 50 people that interview you, in terms of quality, you're number 22. And so here's the report. How do you feel?
Yeah.
Are you curious? Yeah. Are you angry? Are you scared? Are you impatient? All of the above. You're a human being trying to do your best. And now along comes this assessment. And, it would produce all sorts of feelings instead of the one we want is curiosity, learning, maybe joy, maybe excitement about, well, how did interviewer number 48 do it? You know,
yeah.
That's the context you're in. That's determined by whether you're in a context that's primarily surveillant, issuing rewards and punishments, blaming and shaming, or giving gold stars, introducing competitiveness. If we're in a context in which it's all about blaming and shaming, then yeah, you're going to not like it. You're going to, especially if you feel helpless, you're doing your best. And unless I can offer you a system to help you do even better, a learning system, no, you're just going to react to it. That's human. That's human nature, and doctors are human. When you have an environment which is a learning environment, which all the signals around you, the leadership behaviors, the signals are all about the joy of learning, then we can get into a completely different dynamic. And now the information becomes a source of curiosity and investigation and sharing. But that's not how healthcare behaves in general. No, it's not how Western societies behave. It's all about surveillance and rewards and punishments and competition, and that doesn't make anyone feel good.
This attitude that you describe, an open environment where there's a willingness to learn, where people feel safe to share their data, it is done in places,
yes,
in hospitals, and so, but it's very difficult to accomplish it on a national level.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's the first point. It is done. The story I told you about the doctor that threw the paper at me, mm-hmm, that's only half of that day. The other visit I made, I think it was the same day, was to a different center. It was called the Wellesley Center. And I, with some trepidation, did the same thing. I handed out reports. And in that center, something happened, which is when I passed out the papers, remember they were anonymous, so Dr. A, B, C, I was interrupted by the noise as people got out. They literally got out of their chairs. They walked around. They said, I'm Dr. B. Which one are you?
Wow.
And they began immediately curious, sharing. Who's this person? Which of us is this one? It seems like you could. So there was something about that environment in which the emphasis was on curiosity, not on feeling good or bad. I happened to know the reason. The reason was the chairman of that department, a guy named Mark Bard, was a doctor, and he was just a joyful, positive, encouraging presence. He valued everyone, and they knew it. And so there, it wasn't fear that controlled the response. It was fun, curiosity. Maybe we could learn something here. So it is about the context. Now, So that's at the departmental level, let's say. And yeah, you can have a lot of variation. We have actually very good data from a rigorous study done at Mayo Clinic of differences among departments in physician morale. And they were able to show strong connection between that result and the behavior of the leaders. And they actually codified the leadership behaviors that were associated with departments which with high morale, high curiosity, high learning. So it locally, we can do a ton. Nationally, at the governmental level, let's say the Ministry of Health in the Netherlands or or the Department of Health and Human Services in the United States, it's a different situation because at the political level, judgments, positive and negative judgments, seem to dominate instead of learning. And it's a very difficult transition to move to become a learning country, let's say, if
okay.
that's even possible.
Yeah. And in Holland, we've got the insurance companies involved in this movement. And
You have the payers, the accreditors, and they all are giving gold stars or, you know, dunce caps to people. And it's a negative cycle. It can be different. In England, for example, at one point, early on when I got involved in England, or the UK more generally, but especially England, with Tony Blair's first term, they had a serious problem with waiting times. There were long waits for appointments with general practitioners. And Blair cared about that a lot because it was a political issue for him. He knew that he needed to improve that in order to have a good chance at re-election. But he, for reasons I'm not clear about, he approached it with what I would call the right way at that time. He set up a commission on modernizing the care system with the cooperation and help of physician leaders and a system of support to local general practices to learn new scheduling techniques, new ways to manage flow, new ways to manage referrals to specialists. It worked quite well. The waiting times immediately fell, within a year anyway, and a lot of the backlog went away. And that was done in a very positive way. It was kind of fun to work on it. So it's not always the case the government brings the dark shadows. In that case, it was help.
Should quality data be completely transparent for patients?
Yes, I've become pretty convinced that quality data should be completely transparent to patients. All data should be completely transparent to patients. So financial flows, where the money is, who's making money and who's not, quality for sure, experiences of patients, narrative and quantitative. This is a barrier we have trouble leaping over into transparency because of this other problem of too much positive and negative surveillance and rewards and punishments. But I think we have to leap over our shadow on that one. And I think getting transparent is better once you've leapt into that world. I have rarely seen a situation in which data have been made transparent to the public and something terrible has happened, or you know, people have gone backwards. We can get over it.
It's a fear.
It's a fear.
Yeah. You said in an interview with us more than 10 years ago, you said it's time to put the lights on, and you can't improve in the darkness, which to me seemed so clear.
It is clear.
Yes, but still. Still, there is this reluctance to make.
There's reluctance. It's human nature, and especially when there are people out there that want to reward and punish as the primary method of improvement, it just doesn't work. Fear and improvement are incompatible. One of the reasons is that fear reduces the willingness to share knowledge, but it's just the wrong setup. And these are lives we're talking about. These are patients whose lives may depend on transparency and on sharing. Because maybe I'm doing something wrong, and until we learned it, I don't have a chance to say, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. Now I want to do something better. So I still believe in transparency as key. It's not sufficient, because transparency alone will produce fear, of course. Transparency plus support, plus learning processes, plus headroom, transparency plus celebration. All of that can change the psychology of measurement to a learning process. That's the key.
And what's the role of patience in getting more transparency?
I think patients have many roles. One of them is to demand it. This is, after all, your lives, your bodies, and your money. And you have a right to transparency. And I don't know if I told you this story 10 years ago, but I do remember there was a project that I was involved in in the United States with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. Cystic fibrosis is a chronic illness that shortens lives and is very difficult to manage. But the cystic fibrosis centers in the United States, I think there were about 150 of them or so, had formed a voluntary organization to share their data so that weight gain and lung function and death rates were all part of this large database. But it was a secret database, that in the sense that the comparative data from among the 150 or 160 centers was not shared with the public, because the foundation feared that if it shared the data, that the organizations would cease their contributing to the data system. Mm-hmm. But the Board of Trustees was concerned. They felt, on the other hand, maybe patients had a right to the data. And I remember a meeting I was asked to go to of the board with some patients in which they were discussing whether to turn on the lights, whether to have the data become freely available. So you could ask the question, which center in the United States has the best record of preserving lung function or nutritional support or death rates? And there was one of the people there was the mother of a child with cystic fibrosis. Her name was, I think, Honor Page was the woman's name, and I'd come to know her. And they were discussing back and forth whether to be public. And I said to Mrs. Page, do you have an opinion here? What's your thought about transparency? What would you like these people to know? And she said, I'd like you to know that for my daughter, the clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. The clock is ticking. Meaning, would you please get over this now? If there's one among you that's doing the best, find out who it is and go find out what they're doing.
Yeah.
And let me know too.
Yeah.
And that changed. They changed their policy. They became transparent. And whether it's coincident or not, I don't know. But from that year on, the rate of improvement of care doubled at all the centers, the good ones and the bad ones. So I think there's
much to gain from it.
Pardon me?
There's much to gain.
So that's one role of patients. Insist on it. It's your right. Another is you are part of the care system. We co-create the care, and so that transparency can give you ideas yourself about how to do better. And so it's not, you're not just an observer of the healthcare system. You are part of it, and this empowers you to be a more active part of it. I think it's an important step.
Yeah.
By the way, I have to do a commercial here, which is my colleague Kedar Monte and I have started a podcast called Turn on the Lights. Turn on the Lights. And the idea behind Turn on the Lights is to give much more information to the public about healthcare, about its problems, how it works, some bright spots and successes, because I do believe a more informed public will in the long run be a safer and healthier public.
And it's definitely worthwhile listening. Before we talk further about patient safety, we have a special section, and that's who is Don Burek? Now, you've done a lot in quality movement. Maybe you can tell us what brought you on this path.
I'm a pediatrician by training. I haven't practiced in quite a while, but I still feel like a doctor. My father was a doctor in a small town, and my daughter's a doctor, and I feel very much part of that profession. I'm the father of four and the grandfather of eight now, so children and family are very important to me. My wife is a lawyer. We have a wonderful marriage, and she's interested in environment and sustainability, and that's what she's devoted her life to. Very lucky. I've had the benefit of wonderful supports from my family and good health and from the community of effort that's represented in the quality movement now. And, you know, it's a little embarrassing to me to be credited with much of this because I really feel only like a member of a large and growing group of people who want to make healthcare better and are trying to find ways to work together. What got me into this is probably two things. One is that as a young doctor, like all young doctors, I constantly saw things go wrong. Mistakes I made that I didn't mean to make, injuries to people waiting that shouldn't have been there, drop balls, and it, you know, it just didn't seem right to me. And through good luck, I met some people who were much more familiar with modern approaches to improvement. When you get on an airplane today, you are incredibly safe compared to 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Much, much safer. You know, many orders of magnitude. And you're much safer in an airplane than you are in a hospital. So it hadn't happened by accident. It happened because aviation has learned how to make things safer and safer. Healthcare didn't. And as I became aware of these sciences of improvement, I thought, my goodness, this could help us in healthcare. And that began really this part of my career, a group of people who had the same feeling. We started this nonprofit organization, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And it was
beginning of the 90s?
There was a research project in 1986 to 1989 or 90 that kind of began to explore the value of quality improvement. And that all culminated in 1991 with the founding of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, which I then became chief executive of and ran for 19 years. And it was finding gold, finding diamonds, because the whole healthcare community really wants to get better. And once you said, hey, we have a way to do that that doesn't involve punishing you or rewarding you, it involves mm-hmm. learning, you get a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. And then you also had a role in Obamacare, which
I did.
Maybe not all people know. Maybe you can...
Yeah, it was a turn in my career. In 2010, President Obama asked me to come to Washington to run our federal healthcare insurance system, the Medicare and Medicaid, mm-hmm. which covers about one out of every three Americans. It was a very odd experience for me because I was running a small organization, but I think the record we'd had on improving care might have been attractive to the administration. So I went to Washington, and for 17 months, I ran our Medicare and Medicaid system. Obama, as you may recall, became enmeshed in a very contentious environment of where the Democrats and the Republicans could not get along.
They still do not.
It's worse now. but even then, Republicans refused to approve me as the permanent head. So I only was there for about a year and a half, but it was an amazing experience to be in government and take quality improvement into government. One of the things I tried to do was use the improvement skills that I had developed and taught in the government agency. So could the Medicare and Medicaid system, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, be an improvement organization? The answer is definitely yes. It was absolutely wonderful to teach the staff modern improvement. And I only wish I could have continued.
Yeah, that would have been nice. So let's continue on patient safety. We had an interview 2 years ago, and then you said patient safety has fallen off the agenda in the boardrooms of hospitals in the United States. And my impression is that's in the Netherlands the same, because so many other subjects are wanting attention. The shortage of people, the money problem. And so is it better now? And how can we get it back in the boardrooms?
Well, I know about the United States. I don't know for sure about the Netherlands or any other countries for sure. But yeah, it's definitely fallen off the screen. We have surveys of the things that are worrying boards of trustees and executives, and quality is quite low on that list. You know, it's maybe number 5 or number 6 or 7 on the list of their what they're losing sleep about. It's
amazing, actually, because as a patient, if you come to a hospital, it wouldn't be on place 5 or 6. It's the priority of...
I want you to be perfect. But there are things that have displaced quality as a top executive and board concern. Number one, I think, is right now staff. If you go to any executive in the United States, it'll be workplace staffing shortages, staffing morale. They're very worried about enough doctors, enough nurses, enough technicians, and then the ones that are there are felting burnout. The second is going to be money, which is payment systems are under pressure. Healthcare costs in the United States have continued to grow at a fast pace and eating into other opportunities, and so payers are pushing back. Now, everyone's worried about, is there enough money? In England, for sure, it's top. They're worried about cybersecurity and technologies and AI and how that's going to all fit into their systems. I think that the idea that care improvement should be a priority has been weakened. I think if you stop them and you say, what are you really concerned about? Yeah, you could get them to worry about it, it's slipped. We had this kind of period, the heyday of quality around... Oh, I'd say 2000 to 2005 or 10, because of, in the United States, the leadership of the National Academy of Medicine with its reports crossing the quality chasm and to err as human. And it's kind of interest in quality exploded, and it was very high on the list. But nowadays...
And there was a lot of progress then.
There was progress. It was in pockets, progress against particular things. For example... We learned rather quickly how to stop certain kinds of infections in hospitals, like bloodstream infections from IVs and pressure ulcers and pneumonia that you get from a ventilator machine. We had tremendous progress there. Lots, in some cases, hospitals went to zero incidents of those types. So there was progress. Some work on chronic disease management, diabetes care. But all of that, I fear, has slipped. And the goal here, remember, is not just to have projects, but to be transformed as an industry where quality is on everybody's mind every day, and it is the thing. It's the success factor we're all after. That's not the case in most hospitals today.
How important is measurement to improve patient safety?
That's a deep question. One of the aphorisms people use is, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. I've always thought that's a rather silly statement. I mean, there are many things we manage in our lives without measurement. I have a wonderful marriage, and I've never given my wife a questionnaire, and I don't know any numbers related to that, but it's improved, year on year as we mature and learn together. A kid riding a bicycle learns to ride a bicycle, gets better, and there's no measurement. They don't time themselves or count their scrapes. They learn as they go. So we manage many things that we don't measure. You do need some kind of feedback. Maybe it's narrative, like, how did I do, or how are you feeling? But I think measurement can be silly. On the other hand, it can be helpful, and it is, and you can require it and all that, and that's really become a industry all its own. So in the United States, hospitals have to report hundreds or thousands, in some cases, of data points, and I think it's overdone. And it also, it's distracting because, measurement is a shadow of reality. It's not, in hospitals we want gentleness and kindness and reliability and precision. Any measurement of that is really not going to be the thing we're after. It's only a shadow of it.
It gets meaning when the doctors can see what they're doing it for, and it actually leads to improvement. then I could imagine that the doctor says, yeah, this is helping me.
I agree with you. And yes, of course, there are some things, if we are trying to control an infection, I guess I would like to know the patient's temperature. It's a helper in terms of are things getting better or worse? So if in the right frame of mind, a learning frame of mind, sure, then, it can be. It could be quite an assistant, but it's become an industry all its own, and I think needs to be tamed a bit more than we've done in healthcare.
There's also a lot of talk about safety too, mm-hmm. To learn from what goes well, actually. Yeah.
It's not just about safety. I think any dimension of excellence, I really would love to know who's doing great or what happened on Thursday that was so good. Mm-hmm. And learning from the best, learning from the exceptionally good, learning from the positive deviant, we call it, mm-hmm. I think is really helpful. And by the way, much more fun mm-hmm. than studying only the things that go wrong.
Yeah. So that's also, you don't have to choose between safety one measurement and safety.
No. It's both and. We've seen, there's a wonderful example of this in England that I happened upon at Birmingham Children's Hospital. An intensive care doctor, Adrian Plunkett, began a project called Learning from Excellence, LFE, which you can now as a website. But he began to discover that if he and his colleagues could recognize something really good that happened, like on Tuesday, Bart did this amazing thing that helped this patient recover faster or that surprised everybody. And then we can make an inquiry and make it public that this really good thing happened. It's all a positive cycle begins. And learning from excellence is, I think, a terrific project that is safety too. It's not just safety, though. It's quality too.
Quality too. Okay. So before we continue with talking about the challenges, and the political situation in the United States and in the world, maybe. Let's go to this section, where is Dunberg heading? You're still very involved. You're 78 now, I believe. You're still involved in the movement. Do you have some goals you want to reach, or where are you heading?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great time of life. Although I'm aging, I now have... my four children now have produced eight grandchildren, so I get to enjoy the family, which is very, very important to me, and to enjoy these years with my wife while we're still able to. So a lot of more focus on using the time available to have fun and try to experience some of the joy. In the quality movement, there's a lot more needs to be done, and I think my main change has been to become more political. I think we have some problems in leadership, and we really need to demand leadership that is supportive of the important dimensions of improvement. The most important one to me being assuring well-being and better circumstances for people at the most disadvantaged. The poor, the marginalized.
So that we come automatically to our last subject, and that is the present challenges, the political challenge. And I wrote a remark for you in 2013. You said in an interview, "I'm worried about the failure to realize progressive issues I care about: healthcare as a human right, poverty, and justice." These issues are under siege in America. Well, that was in 2013. If you look at today, it's even more. It's getting worse, actually.
It's getting worse. Let me add climate change to that list. The World mm-hmm. Health Organization now says that climate change is the greatest threat to human well-being on the planet, and I believe that belongs on that list. No, it's much worse in the United States. Yesterday, I gave a speech here in the Netherlands, and I began with an apology. That's how I feel as an American. I need to say this is not the country that I want us to be in America, and I'm embarrassed by the behaviors of our pre- president and the leadership now. I'm embarrassed by my countrymen who support those behaviors. We have become a negative force in the world in a way I didn't think was possible. The withdrawal of a commitment to human rights, to restoration of the well-being of the most underprivileged people in my country and in the world, the abandonment of commitments to the global south, the abandonment of commitments to fighting climate change and decarbonization, and the willingness to use ugliness and fear and fear of others as a political tactic. I'm furious about it, and I think it's unworthy of my country. I do feel apologetic about those behaviors, and I will do everything I can to fight them. What this President Trump has done is nothing less than murderous. It's homicidal, killing people through his stroke of his pens, people in my country and to some extent even more people around the world. What we've done with our American commitment to international aid and assistance is unconscionable, and I will do whatever I can to stop it.
Yeah, you were talking about this PEPFAR initiative, started by Bush, actually.
PEPFAR was started by a Republican president, George Bush. It has saved millions and millions, I think as many as 20 million lives.
Yeah.
And Trump, in his viciousness or ignorance, has done what he can to stop USAID and PEPFAR, the PEPFAR program. It's hanging on by its fingernails, and literally millions of lives depend on the continuation of that form of aid. And how we can, as a country, conscience stopping it is beyond my understanding.
So let's return to our topic, leadership in healthcare. Yesterday you said we need a kind of leadership which doesn't focus on controlling but on unleashing energy.
Yeah. I mean, that's just it's just to be smart leading. No leader has the energy or the time or the knowledge to do all the good things that could be done. But the workforce has the knowledge to do the good things that could be done. And a leader who realizes that their job is to help people do what they want to do, not to cause them to do something, is a much smarter leader. You can mobilize so much energy. Will it always be perfect? No, and there'll always be people that are misbehaving, but human nature, I think, although now I'm beginning to be shaken a little bit by what's going on in the United States, but human nature as a whole, I think, is to help others, I think. Certainly that's true of children. You can do experiments with kids which show that they really want to help people, and that's still there inside everybody. So the leader that knows that can ask the question, how can I release that energy? How can I say yes? How can I help people do what
instead
needs
of
to be
saying
done?
No.
Instead of saying no, say yes. And by the way, it's perfectly okay to ask for help, to say there are many things we could do as a hospital, but right now we have this serious issue around patient safety or a challenge around waiting times or a challenge around waste or a challenge around sensitivity to patient needs. Can we all please get together and address that challenge? So leadership partly is to organize around particular aims, but that's not really control. That's servant leadership. That's calling on people's better angels.
Thank you very much. We've talked about the need for transparency. Doctors don't need to be fearful of transparency. We've talked about leadership, which is needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Bart. I appreciate it. I think your role as a communicator to the public is absolutely key because we're not going to make change until the public understands how much is possible.
Thank you.
Tot zover deze aflevering. U hoorde Bart Kiers in gesprek met Don Burwin. Als u vaker naar deze podcast wilt luisteren, klik dan vooral op abonneren in uw podcast-app. En als u zich inschrijft voor de nieuwsbrief van Skipper op Zorgvisie, krijgt u nieuwe afleveringen vanzelf toegestuurd en blijft u ook dagelijks op de hoogte van het laatste nieuws over de gezondheidszorg. Voor nu, hartelijk dank voor het luisteren en heel graag tot de volgende voorzorg.